Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
Hello, I'm Jason.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Freddie.
And on today's episode of the New Statesman podcast, we discuss the fallout from Boris Johnson's not quite resignation speech. So we're recording just after the Prime Minister announced his resignation, or not quite, outside Number 10. And there was this was after a mass exodus of ministers overnight when Johnson was still insisting he'd stagger on. And after some extraordinary moments, the sacking of Michael Gove alongside a briefing calling him a snake, Nadeem Sahawi appointed Chancellor one day and then calling for the Prime Minister's resignation the next. And we're now on the third Education Secretary in 3 days. In his speech, Boris Johnson said the timetable for a Tory leadership election will be announced next week and has appointed a caretaker cabinet, says he'll stay on as Prime Minister until a new leader is in place, but we don't know the timeline yet. It was a very chippy speech. He suggested the herd instinct of Westminster politics was responsible for his departure. He called it an eccentric decision, and he said that he regretted that his arguments to try and persuade his party to let him stay didn't wash. But then he added, them's the breaks. We know many in his party don't want him to stay on, so that's what we'll be discussing on this podcast, what actually happens next. But Jason, thanks for taking the time to join us out of a very busy time trying to put the next magazine together. What did you make of the speech when you watched it?
Well, hi Anoush. What an extraordinary day or extraordinary last couple of days. I've been watching Westminster for a long time and I don't think I've ever seen anything like this. I mean, truly remarkable. What did I think of the speech? I thought there were elements of typical Johnson there. The boosterism, referring back to his big mandate the party won in the 2019 general election. You know, the support for Ukraine, references to levelling up and the vaccine rollout. But I agree with you. It was a slightly chippy speech. Sadness, suppressed anger, I think. The language was interesting. He spoke about when the herd moves, it moves. He spoke about the relentless sledging, which is an interesting term to use. In other words, the verbal abuse that he and those around him have endured in recent days. There was no sense of contrition or humility. And also there was no sense that there was any fixed time for his departure, other than he would make way when a new prime minister or new Tory leader and thus Prime Minister had been chosen. So, you know, it's an open-ended quasi-resignation. I mean, rather typical of Boris Johnson in that sense. But it's an epic day, really, and it's an epic fall for Johnson. I mean, he won an extraordinary majority in 2019 on a decisive but crude pledge to get Brexit done, whatever that means. And to have squandered that opportunity that he was given in December 2019. I mean, this was the job we are led to believe that he always wanted, to be Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. And to be leaving office in these circumstances so soon after, really. And Johnson inhabits a kind of pre-Christian world, of a pagan world, really, of gods and demons. And he has his own kind of skewed moral worldview. But to be defeated in this way is remarkable. And if you think about it, his premiership coincided with the worst crisis since the Second World War, by which I mean the pandemic, you know, the first pandemic to affect the United Kingdom and much of Europe for 100 years. And this coincided with his premiership. So it's been a premiership of perpetual crisis, really. And it's almost as if the gods are mocking him.
Well, thank you so much for sort of laying out that journey that he's been on, which of course we've been covering in great detail at the New Statesman for years. And as a publication, let's just say we've been sceptical, to use one of your favourite words, of his leadership. And we've had some pretty sort of iconic covers. The Pinocchio nose springs to mind. And of course, in 2019, remember when he was running for the leadership, his ex-wife held up a copy of the New Statesman for photographers, depicting him in a cage with the headline restraining order. So does it feel sort of momentous to be covering his downfall as the NS editor at the moment?
Yeah, it is momentous. And we obviously haven't published our next issue of the magazine yet. That comes in 5 or 6 days' time. We responded quickly to the breaking story on Tuesday night. Andrew Marr wrote a brilliant and very quick cover story after he came off air, having been doing his show for LBC. But Johnson's been around such a long time. You know, ever since I was a young journalist on The Times, he was on The Telegraph back then. And I was aware of a cult of personality around Boris Johnson. And he's always divided opinion. There's a group of people who have been close to him and worked with him who absolutely detest him. But there's also a group of people who have been close to him and worked with him who like him and support him, as you see, even at the very end in the bunker, as the house is collapsing on itself and more and more of his ministers are resigning. Nevertheless, there are still a hardcore of loyal Boris Johnson supporters, and they exist in the wider media as well, in that ecosystem of the right-wing press. So he's always commanded extraordinary support, but also extraordinary hostility. You know, our mission on the New Statesman is always to try and understand and explain and analyse the forces in play. But Johnson is a gift to journalists. The chaos that he creates, the larger-than-life personality, no doubt he's charismatic, he's witty, he's fluent, he lacks moral seriousness. And I think he's really struggled to lead. I mean, he's a very, very good campaigner, as we saw during the Brexit campaign and the 2019 general election campaign. But he really doesn't have a skill set to lead, and particularly lead a country such as ours. So I think in many ways his premiership has been absolutely disastrous, and in many ways inevitable too, that it should have ended in this way. But it's still an absolutely epic collapse, I think, from the position he found himself in December 2019. And no doubt we will have great fun over the next few days putting the next issue of the magazine together.
Well, Freddie, you've just come over from actually outside Downing Street. What was the atmosphere like? What did you make of it all?
I thought it was a complete farce, really. We were there in the press pen. They set out speakers so we could try and hear the speech, but the speakers didn't work 2 minutes before.
A metaphor, if ever there was one.
Exactly. 2 minutes before he began speaking, Steve Bray turned up. Steve Bray's the
infamous Romaniac.
Infamous protester who comes to Parliament Square with his speaker protesting Brexit, but also Boris Johnson. So his speaker was blaring throughout. And then on top of that, we had booing and cheers competing as a huge crowd at the bottom of Downing Street. So it wasn't exactly the serious, reflective speech that you might have hoped. But I also think that was reflected in Johnson's speech. There was, I thought, a bitterness to his speech, a snide feeling that I don't think will go down well at all with the Conservative Parliamentary Party. They'll be annoyed. There was no sense of contrition. He's almost set him up. He's drawn the battle lines for the conflict between him and his MPs that is going to play out over the next few days. So I thought it was an interesting tactic to take. And I thought it spoke to the fact that he sees his premiership at least going on for 3 months or so. He is here to fight. As Jason said earlier, he did not resign. He remains party leader. He remains prime minister. We're hoping that the leadership election will happen now and a new leader will come to the fore. But there's a lot of time for Johnson to try and play the game, for try and go to Ukraine again. And there's lots of things that he can do to try and bring back some of the support that he had among MPs.
Yeah, I think you're right to say that he sort of set up that battle with MPs. That has really characterised his premiership, hasn't it? I mean, he notably didn't thank his MPs or ministers. He didn't thank his cabinet. Although who he did thank was the number 10 security staff, who he notably said never leak, which suggests that he, you know, he doesn't really still think he's done anything wrong. It's just that he's been found out.
there was certainly a fear last night among some MPs that this is Johnson's Trumpian turn. And obviously lots of other MPs dismissed that, thought it was an exaggeration. But you are seeing an emphasis on bending constitutional principles, Johnson's repetition that he's got a mandate from the people is not only untrue, it's just not how our system works. Johnson himself
mandate
was not
elected.
Mandate
from the people of Oxbridge and South Ruislip.
Yeah, of course. Sorry, don't want to forget that.
25,300 people voted for him in Oxbridge and South Ruislip.
Yes,
so that is the size of his personal mandate.
And YouGov polling suggests that he would lose his seat if there was an election tomorrow.
Yeah, so he is trying to find a route out. He's trying to find a new source of legitimacy, which I don't think will go down well with the Tory party, and I don't think is compatible with our constitution.
Well, Rachel, what's going on now? Because there are new appointments to the cabinet already, aren't there? I mean, does that suggest that there will be a sort of period of this caretaker stability that some MPs have been calling for?
It's utterly mind-blowing, isn't it? I was on Politics Live earlier today, and while we were on the programme, we kept being interrupted to say, oh, and so-and-so is Education Secretary now, James Cleverly, and Greg Clark is Secretary of State for Levelling Up, and Kit Malthouse is... Duchy of Lancaster, there we go. And you're like, these are all people either who Boris Johnson sacked, but more importantly, why are you taking these jobs in a government that is by definition a caretaker government? I think there was a sort of sense last night that if he resigned, the sensible thing to do would just be to reappoint everyone who resigned in protest and have that sense of continuity. But no, he's gone for fresh faces there, that combined with various other things like the fact that he adamantly refused to resign all of yesterday when you were getting resignations at a rate of sort of every couple of minutes or five ministers resigning on one letter, which was particularly amusing, and the speech, as has been discussed, that had no contrition, no regrets, no admission of fault, and set himself up against the sort of herd mentality of Westminster and referred to the Conservatives' eccentric decision to get rid of him. All of that suggests to me that he doesn't really deep down still think that he's going. And he didn't actually say that he was going. He said that you know, there'll be a process for a new leader. That's not quite the same thing as actually stepping down. And I think, you know, Freddie's right. 6 weeks, 8 weeks is a really long time in politics. Look at what happened with the Partygate scandal that looked like it was just about to tip over and oust him. And then suddenly Russia invades Ukraine. And I really think he is counting on something turning up that will enable him to stay in power. I don't think he's got it yet. I think he thinks he's under fire and he still has to fight. And the idea that, no, actually, this is the end, we might all think that. I don't think he thinks that.
Right. Jason, what do you think of this idea of him staying on? I mean, a lot of Conservative MPs are extremely concerned about this.
He obviously will go as Prime Minister. He won't be Prime Minister come the autumn, but he will try and stay on for as long as he possibly can, I think. And I think that's probably going to be another battleground. A lot of Conservative MPs are very unhappy about an open-ended continuation to his premiership. The wait for a new Conservative leader to be elected. And there may even be pushes for a kind of caretaker prime minister. Some of those who have come to the cabinet, Malthouse and James Cleverly, are old loyalists. They're old allies of Boris Johnson, but obviously Greg Clark isn't. But it is an extraordinary period because it wasn't officially a resignation of a kind that Theresa May gave when she stepped down. So it is typical Boris Johnson. But of course, he operates outside the rules, really. He's always sought to create his own rules and in many ways his own morality, because he sees himself as a man of destiny, I think. He's very interested in the great man view of history and how heroic individuals kind of drive historic change. And that's why I referred back to his education as a classicist and his interest in ancient Rome and Greece, the classical world, the pre-Christian world that fascinates him so much. I mean, he does see himself as a man of destiny. So for this, what has happened to him now will be a source of a not incredible pain, but also humiliation. To be defeated in this way and to be brought down in this way, I mean, it is hubris on his part. And there is a tragic dimension to Johnson's fall, I think. And his many detractors will be delighting, and indeed they are delighting in what has happened to him today, or indeed over recent days. But he's the author of his own misfortune. There's no doubt about it. There's no point in him blaming the herd or the mob or the sledgers at Westminster. I mean, Boris Johnson has destroyed Boris Johnson.
So who do you think could potentially replace him, Jason? I mean, we know that these rival leadership campaigns are already up and running. The latest briefing, I think, has been Jake Berry could potentially be a contender, head of the Northern Research Group. Of course, the Red Wall Conservative MPs are looking for a sort of new lodestar. What do you think, Jason?
I think Sunak and Javid are well placed, having moved very quickly this week. The first to jump ship, as it were. And also they've got a very coherent view of what they want conservatism to be. I think, Anoush, you wrote about it in your very good analysis of, was it Sunak's resignation letter?
Yeah, thank you.
And you know, here is a desire, I think, to move the Conservative back to the free market, right, low taxes, limited government, smaller state. And I think if Javid and Sunak do some kind of deal and run on the same ticket, they could be formidable and very hard to beat, I think. Despite the problems that Sunak has had in recent times when he was Chancellor. Other contenders is Ben Wallace, or will he be too damaged by staying in the ship for too long? Liz Truss is obviously positioning herself, popular among the grassroots, but I think an unconvincing candidate. I think it's going to be very hard for Jeremy Hunt and Tugendhat, you know, sort of moderate centrists. Hunt, in many ways, is still seen as a Cameroon. And I think Brexit still runs through the Conservative Party in the way that appeasement ran through the Conservative Party after the Second World War and ultimately prevented someone like Rad Butler ever becoming Prime Minister because of the side of the argument he was on over appeasement before the Second World War. And I think Brexit similarly will play a big part in the leadership contest. In other words, I think a Brexiteer will ultimately emerge as the next prime minister. I don't think the party will return to a liberal Remainer such as Jeremy Hunt, even though Hunt has positioned himself differently now and has accepted the inevitability of Brexit and all that comes with it. So it's a very open race. But I think Javid and Sunak are well placed, actually.
Freddie, what are you hearing from the MPs that you're speaking to?
Yeah, I think Jason's right in that Tugendhat and Hunt will seek to try and win support among the more liberal aspects of the party. You'll see the One Nation caucus, for instance, basically run a primary to see who their main candidate should be. And then I think Jason's also right on Sajid, but I would say on that he's seen as not very charismatic at all, and people are concerned that he doesn't have the communication skills to maintain Johnson's coalition from 2019, because that's in the back of lots of Tories' minds at the moment. How do we maintain this coalition, a lot of which was forged because of Brexit? Mm-hmm. So they need a leader who's able to do that. I think there's the same criticism can be applied to Sunak. If Sunak wants this sort of low tax, debt management, fiscal policy, then you're struggling to attract some of those northern voters who might have been won over by levelling up, for instance. So there are pitfalls in many of the, I mean, Liz Truss, you know, she voted for Remain, even though she's done a concern. she's really tried to.
The metamorphosis of Liz Truss from Remainer to, you know,
hardcore
Brexiteer, yeah. Let's blow up our international treaties. It's quite miraculous.
It has, yeah, it's been something to witness.
But she will be seen as coming from the libertarian right, won't she, Liz Truss? So in that sense, I think Freddie's makes a good point about holding Johnson's 2019 coalition together. I think it'd be extremely difficult for them to do so. The thing about Johnson, the reason why he was such a dangerous opponent for the left was that he didn't ultimately believe in anything. He wasn't really a small state, low tax, free market ideologue. He was pragmatic. He didn't mind spending money, didn't mind putting up taxes. He didn't mind having a big interventionist state. So in that sense, he was unpredictable and he changed his mind. He was flexible and he was pragmatic. And that made him, I think, particularly dangerous.
Yes, yes. And of course, it's a big question as well for the Labour Party, isn't it? Who they would most like to go up against and who they would least like to go up against. And they do insist, you know, insiders in Keir Starmer's office insist that Rishi Sunak sort of would be an easy opponent. But they have always said, you know, the best case scenario, not for the country, but for the Labour Party's prospects, is Boris Johnson staggering on. So if he doesn't, you know, there is an open question there of who would be the most dangerous potential contender against Keir Starmer, although we haven't heard from the Durham police yet. Rachel, what do you think? Who would be Labour's sort of best and worst case scenario?
I think they'll probably have a lot of fun if it's Rishi Sunak, partly with his background, although we had a feature a couple of weeks ago on how Rishi Sunak's background and that of his wife actually play well with Britain's Hindu-Indian community, which Labour have found very difficult to reach and don't quite understand why. But putting that aside, having a sort of billionaire wife whose tax status is a bit dodgy, while saying that there's no money left to do anything about the cost of living crisis, I think is helpful to Labour. We haven't mentioned Zahawi here, who clearly definitely thinks of himself as a contender. When the history books write about this period of history, the fact that Johnson lost a chancellor, appointed a new one, and then the next day that chancellor is calling for him to go, I mean, absolutely mind-boggling. And that seems to have been a strategy on Zahawi's part. We were hearing reports today that actually he's been meeting with consultants and thinking about a leadership bid for some time. So clearly he thinks that this is the way to it, to kind of build on his success as vaccine minister, become chancellor, become a household name, and then rise to be leader that way. A lot of people are also talking about Penny Mordaunt. I mean, people are always talking about Penny Mordaunt. Nobody wants Penny Mordaunt to happen more than Penny Mordaunt does. But she is seen, there's a lot of stuff going for her. The fact that she is a Brexiteer who was well respected in the Defence Department, and even though she has been a minister in Johnson's government, she's been quite distant and often critical of him, so perhaps isn't as tarnished as some of the other people involved, although I often hear that she believes in herself perhaps more than anyone else believes in her. And no, let's not forget, if there were a clear and obvious front runner, we wouldn't be in this situation now, because the vote of no confidence a few weeks ago would have been much better organised and directed and would have succeeded.
That's a really good point. So I think we will be covering the ins and outs of the Tory leadership election for many podcast episodes to come. But now we have to move on to our second section. Hi, it's Anoush here. This is just a reminder that as a podcast listener, you have the option of subscribing to The New Statesman with a very special offer. You can subscribe for just £1 a week. That's 12 weeks for £12 if you go to newstatesman.com/podcast offer. We'll be right back.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
You Ask Us.
Well done, Jason.
I try.
So our question today, thanks for writing in. Our listener asks, what part, if any, will Johnsonism play in the forthcoming Conservative leadership election and the forthcoming government, the next Prime Minister? Jason.
Wow. What was Johnsonism anyway? It was a curious, curiously incoherent, I think. What was it? A combination of kind of boosterism, rhetoric about levelling up. And I think Johnson was at least serious in his desire to level up, whatever that ended up meaning. He had some good brains in that levelling up unit: Gove, Neil O'Brien, Danny Kruger and others. Andy Haldane, former chief economist of the Bank of England, who's no right winger, was very much involved as well. Support for Ukraine, rhetoric about cutting taxes while raising taxes. So that was always contradictory. Johnsonism is really an ideology of many contradictions. So therefore, it's not an ideology at all. It's completely incoherent. It was built around the extraordinary personality and charisma of Boris Johnson. But whoever becomes the leader of the Conservative Party, Anoush, and thus Prime Minister, will inherit an extraordinarily difficult situation. cost of living crisis about which you write so well, rising inflation, the threat of the war in Ukraine, you know, the worst war in Europe since the Second World War, the rise of China, and not least the fragmentation of the United Kingdom itself. Nicola Sturgeon and the Scottish independence movement are mobilising for a second independence referendum. They may not get it, but that won't stop them mobilising for it. And Sturgeon argues very powerfully that already that she has a mandate for a second referendum, or at least the SNP have a mandate for a second referendum, and she will keep pushing that. And the kingdom is fragmented as I think it's been since the Second World War. Rise of English nationalism, Scottish nationalism, these are big forces in play. And I guess what we need more than anything else is a change of style, a more serious, more sober, more principled, more ethical approach to leading the country. It's been hysterical, melodramatic, erratic, careless. It's been a very dark time, I think, for the country. But whoever comes next will have a really difficult job, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And if there's anything that we can sort of take from Johnsonism, and you did lay out well there how sort of contradictory a kind of an ideology it is his willingness to spend money where other Conservatives, particularly his own Chancellor, were reluctant to. And I feel that it will be something that whoever is next taking charge will want to move away from, but they will struggle to do so because the public is now used to very high levels of public spending because of the response to the pandemic. And you saw that in the crash in Rishi Sunak's ratings when he announced his spring statement, which was seen as far too meagre for the challenge of the cost of living crisis.
There was always that contradiction within Brexit itself, Anoush, where you had the free market right talking about a kind of buccaneering Britain that's going to go out into the world, and an expression of mass disaffection, particularly in those red wall constituencies, where I think many voters were looking for protection against the forces of free market globalisation. In other words, they were looking for greater security and a sense of social cohesion rather than a buccaneering, free market, enterprising new model Britain, whatever that would be. So that in itself is another contradiction that will play out, I think.
Yeah, I think the contradictions of Brexit are absolutely crucial there because, yes, it's completely right. There were sort of two very different visions of Brexit which couldn't be reconciled. And the genius of the Leave campaign was to manage to fudge the difference and to present a very sort of Boris Johnson cakeism, I'm pro-eating it and pro-having it, idea that you could sort of take back control and cut all your trade ties and have full sovereignty over all the things that you wanted to do, which you can, but without it making people poorer. And one of the things that Johnson has been very successful at is continuing to straddle those two forms of Brexit. And every time it looked like it wasn't working, blame, oh, the EU or the unelected judges or the Labour Party or the Remainiacs or the technocrats or the media, us, it's our fault. But basically, there was always someone to blame for why Brexit wasn't able to be these two completely contradictory things. And with him gone, I don't see anyone else in the Conservative Party who would be able to do that. Now, certainly there are hard Brexiteers on the free market right who are very pro this cutting all the red tape, Singapore on Thames, sort of free market approach. Are they really going to go on TV and say, this is the kind of Brexit we're having, and yes, you're all going to lose your jobs and it will make you poorer, but it won't matter because we'll have sovereignty? Is that really going to go down in the northern seats that voted for Brexit because they were concerned about immigration or because they wanted more spending on the NHS? I don't think there's anyone else who's able to walk that tightrope at the moment, especially at a time of economic crisis. And actually, I think the delusion in the Conservative Party is that there is somebody who's able to do that and that will will last long enough to win them the next election.
And I do think those sort of high tax, higher spending elements of Johnsonism will have to continue to an extent, because with that record waiting list for the NHS, for example, just one example, you know, you can't shrink the state when you've got that going on.
Yeah, we have a massive ageing population. We have greater need for social security spending. These are problems that any leader who comes in has to deal with. Having said that, I think we need to remember that all these potential leadership candidates are desperate to be prime minister. They won't mind if they have to spend the winter in a recession. They won't mind if they have to try and at least attempt to deal with the cost of living crisis. The cabinet and some senior backbenchers have been planning for this moment for a very long time. They won't be put off by the problems that they face.
Why would you want it? Why? Save yourselves if you're listening, which of course they all are.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, the New Statesman editor, Jason Cowley, and my colleagues, Rachel Cunliffe and Freddie Haywood. We're produced by Chris Stone, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks so much for listening, and don't forget to subscribe and leave us a nice review. And if you want to send a question in to You Ask Us, email podcasts@newstatesman.co.uk.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.